Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before ABC coined the phrase, "Will you accept this rose?" there was another very popular reality dating show that captured audiences in the 1960s with the upbeat music of Herb Albert and contestants, sometimes celebrities, looking for love, or people that would go on to become celebrities. The program ran on ABC from 1965 to 1971 before entering syndication, and had various hosts over the years. It was originally shown in black and white, but when a primetime version began to air in October of 1966, both versions were broadcast in color, which was a big deal at the time. It became the first ABC daytime series to be regularly broadcast in color. The dating game was insanely popular. So much so that celebrities like Tom Selleck, Michael Jackson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Farrah Fawcett, among dozens more, found themselves in the hot seat, asking strangers questions or fielding questions themselves at various stages of their Hollywood careers. The premise of the show was a simple one. One suitor, typically the woman, would ask three contestants simple questions as they were hidden from their sight, though the live audience and viewers at home could see the faces of those competing for a chance to win and take the leading man or woman out on the town on ABC's dime. Some questions were off limits, like asking about occupation or age or income, and many answers to seemingly innocent questions turned downright raunchy, especially in the show's later years. But there was a major difference between the vetting process of the dating game and the Bachelor franchise. There wasn't one. Now, I'm not sure if background checks were really a thing back in the 1960s and 70s, but knowing what we know now about notorious serial killers running around at the time, it's terrifying. But even more chilling was when a contestant, a man by the name Rodney Alcala, passed through whatever minimal screening process was in effect for the show. Perhaps because he was tall, handsome, and devilishly charming.
I'm our show, and your host, Jim Lai. Hey! Thank you very much. And welcome to the dating game. And we'll get right underway. It's time to meet our first three eligible bachelors for game number one. And here they are. Good luck, gentlemen. Well, let's see. Bachelor number one is a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the dark room at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, he might find him skydiving or motorcycling. Please welcome Rodney Alcala. Rod, welcome.
That was the intro to Rodney Alcala on the dating game. What are the odds that a show like this would find themselves showing the face of such a notorious killer? Well, apparently pretty good. Because 35-year-old Rodney Alcala, who had become known as the infamous dating game killer, found himself on that very stage in 1978 as a contestant, Bachelor number one to be exact. And this was after he had killed at least five people including a child and a pregnant woman, which is absolutely mind-blowing. And he wasn't the only contestant on a game show that would go on to kill. If you're curious, I would look up John Cooper on the British game show called Bullseye, but I digress. Maybe we'll do a full episode on him, actually. Not a bad idea. And just a side note, as with many of our episodes, there are trigger warnings galore ahead for detailed descriptions of sexual and physical abuse against women and children and gruesome details of murders committed. So please take care when listening. But back to the case, and some of these behind-the-scenes facts are simply shocking. When Rodney filmed the now infamous episode, he had already served 34 months in prison for the rape and brutal beating of an 8-year-old girl, Tali Shapiro, in 1969, which we will discuss more in detail here shortly. He had found himself on the FBI's most wanted list for a short period of time as well. How difficult would it have been to figure out by the producers back in 1978? Did they never go to a post office? Things are so much easier these days with all the technology at our fingertips, but it seems like scanning a couple forms of documentation like the FBI Most Wanted list would be a high priority. Which reminds me of the infamous Rosalynn Carter and John Wayne Gacy photo. And that oversight wasn't just with producers of a TV show. It was with the Secret Service. Gacy likely believed his political connections made him above suspicion. He was part of the local Democratic Party, and he was able to attend this private event where Rosalynn Carter was at. Even though, in the photo, he has got like a pin that says he's granted Secret Service clearance. The Secret Service cleared him, even though John Wayne Gacy had already been to prison in Iowa the previous decade for sexually abusing a minor. Just didn't look into it? Anyways, back to Rodney Alcala. The Dating Game's husband and wife production team of Mike and Ellen Metzger did disagree at first about casting Rodney on The Dating Game. Ellen found him hilarious and charming, while Mike recalled feeling uneasy in an interview with ABC's 2020, saying, quote, "He had a mystique about him that I found uncomfortable." But the handsome photographer, skydiver, and motorcycle enthusiast made his way through casting with flying colors and shined in that bright stage spotlight. But as fans of The Bachelor know all too well, he was definitely there for the wrong reasons. Albeit his demeanor and good looks won over the audience and the heart of the bubbly, beautiful brunette contestant looking for love, in spite of some lewd answers to her questions. According to People magazine article, the ABC program was heavy on sexual innuendo. Host Jim Lang introduced Alcala, as heard in the earlier clip, as a successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in a darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Throughout the episode, Alcala enthusiastically responded to the Bachelorette's suggestive questions like, "I'm serving you dinner. What are you called? And what do you look like?" Responding that, quote, "I'm called the banana and I look good. Peel me." And dear listeners, feel free to dry heave there as you're at work or, driving in the car listening to this, because I just did and had to redo the take. David Greenfield was a producer on the show in the 1970s and would later talk to ABC News about Rodney Alcala's time on the show and his raunchy answers, saying, "In retrospect, it sounds horrible, but at the time, that's a good, solid answer. We were looking for raunchy, sexy answers, and that was one. Take it in context now, it's like, oh my God." Bachelor number two, Jed Mills, would later recall Rodney's rude behavior and his tendency to interrupt and act obnoxious when the mood struck. Quote, "He became very unlikable and rude, and imposing as though he was trying to intimidate. I wound up not only not liking him, this guy, not wanting to be near him, he got creepier and more negative. He was a standout creepy guy in my life. And here's a clip of Jed talking with Inside Edition about his experience with Rodney on the show.
Dating show. He was a real creepy guy, a real idiot.
Jed Mills was bachelor number two, and nearly 40 years later, he's still haunted by their encounter.
This creep comes up and he puts his face practically in my face and he says, "I always get the girl." When I think about what he said, "I always get my girl," he kills him. That's what he's talking about.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Cheryl Bradshaw, the contestant on the episode he appeared on in 1978, actually picked him as the winner over the other two contestants. The pair was slated to attend private tennis lessons in LA's amusement park, Magic Mountain, with a chaperone from the show. But the day after the episode was taped, Cheryl called contestant coordinator Ellen Metzger before their planned date to ask if she could back out. Thank goodness for women's intuition. That is some historical, legendary, life-saving gut intuition. And hey, side note, if any of you have ever had gut intuition, a moment that saved your life, or even if you didn't find out that the person was a killer but just had the worst vibe ever, email your story to 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to include it in a listener stories episode. So, Cheryl called and said, "I can't go out with this guy. There's weird vibes that are coming off of him. He's very strange. I am not comfortable." And things could have ended very differently for her. Police didn't make the connection until decades after this now infamous appearance that he was a prolific serial killer, wreaking havoc coast to coast. Cheryl would tell the Sydney Telegraph years later, in 2012, that, "I started to feel ill. He was acting really creepy. I turned down his offer. I did not want to see him again." David Greenfield later told ABC News that, "When I watch the show now, it's hard for me to watch it without looking behind his eyes and knowing what this guy had to be thinking. Just the evil behind the smile. There's sometimes where I can see it, but I think that's my mind working overtime because, again, I can't imagine anybody that would commit a crime and then purposely go on television. That is pure, unadulterated narcissism for you guys." Here's a clip from an interview on 2020.
"Looking back, it is chilling to realize that this iconic show celebrating love and romance and unknowingly feature a remorseless killer."
Thank you. Welcome once again to the Dating Game.
But let's back up a bit. Who was this man, really? And what about his past might have caused him to snap? Unfortunately, after hours of research into these two episodes, yes, it's a two-parter, I'm not sure we will ever have an answer to that. What we do know about his early years is that he was born Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucor on August 23rd, I probably pronounced the Bucor part right, and I'm not even sure about Jacques, but I think I'm correct. On August 23rd, 1943, in San Antonio, Texas. He spent his early childhood in Mexico before he moved with his mother and siblings to Los Angeles after his father abandoned the family when he was a young boy. Friends from his younger years remembered him as being outgoing and fun. Several years later, at age 17, Rodney enlisted in the army and was ultimately demoted in rank in 1964 after suffering a nervous breakdown and allegations of sexual misconduct surfaced. He then received a medical discharge from service after a severe antisocial personality disorder diagnosis. Without facing any official charges, he's a slippery one, Rodney then enrolled in the University of California before transferring to University of California, LA, where he graduated in 1968 with a fine arts degree. His propensity to not stay in one place for too long resulted in him moving across the country. Rodney ventured out east after his first known sexual assault, also in 1968, involving a young girl that we will get into later in the episode. Rodney began to attend classes in New York City under the alias John Berger, and was even in a class with Roman Polanski after getting into New York University's film school. It didn't take too long for him to murder a woman in New York, a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant, Cornelia Michael Crilly, though we have no way of knowing if she was his first kill. Her boyfriend, Leon Borstein, was temporarily living with her while she was in the process of moving into an apartment around the corner on East 83rd Street with a friend. He wasn't able to get a hold of her one day after she was supposed to spend the day moving, and he was alarmed to find the door to her new apartment locked. No one would answer the door or the phone, so he called the police. The authorities entered the apartment to find her dead body stripped naked. It appeared as though she had been strangled with one of her own nylon stockings. She had been bound and gagged. In my opinion, that gruesome of a scene is not someone's first kill. We all know this from true crime and this podcast and all the other, you know, true crime podcasts I assume you listen to and TV shows, that they escalate. In my opinion, there is no way that is his first kill. Without the forensic technology we have today, the case remained cold for 40 years. 40 years is a long time. I feel so bad for her loved ones. How do you move on from that? But Rodney Alcala wasn't even a suspect at the time. He was still using the alias John Berger, and had now moved to New Hampshire to be a camp counselor, that's terrifying, at an arts and drama camp for girls. When I say my eyes bugged out of my head when I had read that little tidbit, terrifying to think what may have taken place there, and what probably did, in all likelihood. But as we know from so many of these stories, these people know how to go find work, or volunteer, or put themselves in a place where they are near the vulnerable. God willing, I get to become a parent one day, and to say I'm going to be a helicopter parent after doing this podcast is not only an understatement, it's a fact, and yeah, lots of people are going to be screened. But in an interesting twist of fate, and sometimes kids are so dang smart, thankfully, two of his campers slash students recognized his face on the FBI Most Wanted poster at the local post office when they ventured into town to more than likely mail letters home. They called their dean, who called authorities, and they finally caught this slippery bastard. He was taken into custody and was ready to be handed over to authorities in California for the brutal assault of young Tali Shapiro, which I suppose we might as well get into now. But be warned, this is going to be hard to listen to, as it was hard to read about and recap. In the twisty timeline of Rodney Alcala, there's one unbelievable tale of survival from long before his appearance on The Dating Game. And we briefly touched on it earlier in the episode. This assault, it occurred 10 whole years prior to that television stint. 8-year-old Tali Shapiro was temporarily living in a hotel with her father, mother, sister, and brother because their family home had caught on fire. That is already fodder for childhood trauma. She was simply walking to her Los Angeles elementary school on a sunny day in September of 1968 from the famed Chateau Marmont, where her seemingly wealthy family was staying, when a beige-colored car pulled up alongside her. The man inside asked Tally if she wanted a ride. Rodney had lied, of course, and told the girl he was a friend of her parents, which didn't seem too far-fetched. Tally's father worked in the music business, and stars like Jim Morrison and Lenny Bruce would regularly visit the family. Quote, "It was totally possible that he knew my parents," she told People magazine years later. "There were always people going in and out of my house. It was like Grand Central Station." But thank God, an LAPD detective, Chris Camacho, and another concerned citizen were in the area at the time, or the outcome likely would have been much, much different. It just breaks my heart for the innocent, trusting child involved.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Years after the incident, the former detective called to CBS News that he had just started his shift and was patrolling near Sunset Boulevard when he received a call about the same beige car with no license plates following a small child. The Good Samaritan that made the call, Donald Haynes, thought the scene was suspicious and had enough wits about him to follow the suspect to their home. Quote, "He was fixated on this little girl and that disturbed me," he told People magazine. Once he saw the child get into the back seat of Rodney's vehicle, all signs were there. All bets were off. Donald followed them. He followed them to the apartment complex that Rodney likely lived in. But Donald was scared to approach Rodney once they got to the apartment complex. He feared he may have a gun or weapon. Who knows? So instead, he found the nearest payphone and quickly called 911. Chris Camacho later recounted the events that unfolded after he reached the location and knocked on the door. In an article from CBS News, he stated, "I said, 'Police officer, open the door. I need to talk to you.' This naked male appeared at the door. I will always remember that face at the door. A very evil face. And he says, I'm in the shower. I gotta get dressed." And here's a terrifying clip from an interview he did later with ABC's 2020. And I can feel the pain in his voice.
"I see this male person on the other side, no clothes, not dripping with water, no towel. And I said, 'Okay, you need to open the door right now. I need to come in.' And he said, 'Wait, let me put my pants on.' And I said, 'Okay, you got 3 seconds. I probably waited 5 seconds and I kicked the door in. To the right was a dining room, to the left was a living room, and straight ahead was a kitchen. And here was this little girl, blood all over the place, clothes, shoes, and a dress thrown to one side. There was coins on the floor, and she had this steel bar across her neck, which probably weighed 2 pounds.
He and the Orange County Deputy DA remembered that image solemnly. All the blood, the white Mary Janes that were now blood-stained red, the metal barbell that had been used to strangle the tiny, lifeless body. It had also been used to bash her head in so much that the officers thought Tally was surely dead. She wasn't breathing. Detective Camacho frantically began tearing through the apartment looking for the suspect. And then, a miracle. Tally started gagging and trying to breathe. He chose to wait with her until paramedics arrived and took her to the hospital. Tally would later go on to tell the New York Times in 2021 that, quote, "I know it's awful what happened to me, but I've never identified with it. I've moved on with my life, so this doesn't really affect me. It's a long time coming, but he's got his karma." She survived the attack with 27 stitches in the back of her head. She was in a coma for 32 days and hospitalized for months before making a full physical recovery. And as for the reason she went to the apartment in the first place, Rodney told her he wanted to show her a picture. The last thing she remembered about that fateful day was walking up the stairs to his apartment with him, a fact that I take comfort in for her sake. Here is part of an interview Tally did with ABC's 2020 Years Later, recounting what few details she remembered about that day. You also hear the voice of author Stella Sands in this clip, who wrote The Dating Game Killer.
And then the horror story of Tally begins.
I remember the morning was nice and warm because I wore the dress that my nanny had crocheted for me.
And a car pulls up alongside of her, and the man leans out and says, I have a beautiful picture I'd like to show you.
And I guess asked if I needed a ride to school. And I told him I didn't talk to strangers.
And he pulled up alongside of her a little further, kept trolling her.
And that's when he told me he knew my parents. And I really didn't want to get in the car, but I was raised to respect my elders. I got in the car, that's when he asked what time my school started. And then that's when he realized that we had plenty of time and he was gonna swing by and show me a poster. You know, I didn't know to fear people.
Because of that compassion the officer had for Tally, Rodney got away, slipping through the back door, but not without leaving some very damning evidence behind. The officer didn't want to leave Tally. He knew he'd get the man someday. The residence contained a lot of photography equipment and photos of girls, some of them very young. But the biggest piece of evidence discovered that day was a photo ID of a UCLA student named Rodney Alcala. One of his UCLA professors later told detectives that Rodney was a great guy and wouldn't hurt anybody. That's the same charm that got him on the dating game in the first place, I reckon. Fast forward back to that New Hampshire post office recognition. Once Rodney was placed in custody and transferred back to California, state police were eager to throw the book at him for Tally's horrific assault. Unfortunately, by this point years later, Tally's family had left the country to make their home in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. There were no main witnesses to put on the stand, so unfortunately, prosecutors had no choice but to offer Rodney a deal, which he ultimately took. He pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of child molestation and agreed to register as a sex offender. The sentence was 1 year to life and he was paroled just after 34 months. Less than 3 years for what he put Tally Shapiro through. And all that recovery time and medical bills she racked up. He was paroled in August of 1974. And within a few weeks of his release, he was arrested, yet again, for marijuana possession while with a 13-year-old girl and returned to prison in 1977. Another instance that could have ended much differently for that young girl. So think about that. That's 1977. He's arrested again with a 13-year-old girl for marijuana possession, and he's on the dating game less than a year later, 1978. So what was his MO? How did he lure his victims in? Well, for one, I was shocked to learn he was eventually hired by the LA Times to work as a typesetter in 1977, after his prison stints. Again, likely no background checks. But he also spent his time taking photos at weddings, all while being an actual registered sex offender. I just find this all so shocking. It makes you really wonder, if you were a working professional in the 1970s, who was sitting at the desk next to you? Like Ann Rule, the stranger beside me, and Ted Bundy. Rodney often posed as a friendly, charming photographer on his days off, approaching his victims on the street and offering to take their pictures. The backdrop was usually a scheduled place far away from prying eyes of the public. It was there that he would attack his victims, up and down the East and West coasts, and hell, even in the middle of the country, as we'll learn next week, using various aliases. It would only become clear later the true evil behind these attacks. Victims were sexually assaulted before they were killed, and autopsies of some victims would reveal that he would strangle the women and wait for them to regain consciousness before taking their lives. He would also arrange the corpses of women in poses before taking their jewelry as a sort of trophy. And this is where we will leave this horrific episode for now. Next week, we will learn how Rodney was ultimately caught for good and hear stories from other survivors. Thank you guys so much for listening. I appreciate you so much. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. You're going to have a wonderful Christmas. And I love you. I really appreciate you. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Thank you. Until next week.
What's your best time?
The best time is at night. Nighttime.
Why? Despite all Calla's weird behavior on the dating game, the Bachelorette chose him, but never went on the date because she reportedly found him creepy. Lucky for her, because Alcala would later be found guilty of 7 murders. Investigators believe he may have actually killed up to 130 victims based on photos found on his property.
Say hello to Rodney Alcala!
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case, now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.